Exodus chapter 32 verses 21 to 35, the 31st talk in a series on Exodus, was presented by David Crabtree on October 1, 2017 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 29, Exodus 32, 21 through 35, accompanies this talk.
Okay, we're continuing in the book of Exodus, chapter 32. I did the first half of chapter 32 last week, and I'm finishing that chapter and this incident this week. As you'll recall, in the incident of the golden calf, Moses had been up on the mountain receiving from God instructions as to how he was supposed to build the tabernacle and all of its furniture, and the priests, how the priests were to be clothed, and some other instructions associated with those things. But God then said to Moses, it's time for you to go down. Some bad things are happening in the midst of the people of Israel. So Moses went down, and the people had talked Aaron into creating a golden bull, and they were worshiping the bull, and they were partying. They were playing. And Moses came down, was outraged at what had happened and what they were doing, and threw the tablets that God had given him of the Ten Commandments, threw those down and broke those, breaking the covenant that had been made between the people of Israel and God. So we pick it up, verse 21 then. Then Moses said to Aaron, "What did this people do to you that you have brought such great sin upon them?" And Aaron said, "Do not let the anger of my Lord burn. You know the people yourself, that they are prone to evil. For they said to me, 'Make a God for us who will go before us.' For this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And I said to them, "Whoever has gold, let them tear it off." So they gave it to me, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf. So Moses is upset. Moses is angry, and he comes to Aaron. If you'll recall, before Moses went up onto the mountain, he had told the people that if anything came up, if there were any matters that needed to be judged, that Aaron and Hur would be there to make those judgments. So Aaron has a position of authority given to him by Moses, and so it makes sense that Moses would come to Aaron and ask for an accounting for what has happened. He uses the term, "You have brought such great sin upon them." Great sin, as I pointed out last week, in the rest of the culture and elsewhere in the ancient Near East, that term, great sin, refers to adultery. In Israelite culture, later on, that term is going to be used exclusively for idolatry. But I think here it has the connotations of an act that is adulterous, and I'll talk more about that later. So Aaron responds, and his response is, don't be mad at me. You know these are bad people. And then he goes through and says what happened, and the way he describes it is virtually word for word what it said earlier in the chapter when the narrator was telling us what happened. So he gives an account that is factually accurate. It's the last sentence that jumps off the page. So they gave it to me, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf. Words are wonderful. When my family first moved to Eugene many years ago, 40 years ago or whatever it was, we moved into a house and redid the landscaping and put in a new lawn. And right after we had planted the new lawn, the next day we were out in the front yard and there were bicycle tire tracks, right? There was a rut that went right through the yard. We figured that the most likely person to have done that was the neighbor boy right next door, Billy. So Mom asked Billy if he knew anything about those tire tracks in our lawn. And he said, yes, it was my sister's bicycle. I love that. It is such a great example of how horrible lies can be told with facts. They're just arranged and couched in a way that's misleading, that leads you to a conclusion that's not true, and which is exactly what he's doing here. Out popped this calf. He avoids any responsibility for it. It's a lot like, you remember the story in Genesis with Adam and Eve. Adam does a similar kind of thing. Okay, so it is interesting to me that Aaron is held accountable here. There is some wrongdoing on Aaron's part. But it's not the same kind of wrongdoing as the people as a whole. And I'll talk about this later. When we get into this a little bit more in verse 25. So verse 25. Now when Moses saw that the people were out of control, for Aaron had let them get out of control to be a derision among their enemies, then Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, whoever is for the Lord, come to me. And all the sons of Levi gathered together to him. And he said to them, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, every man of you put his sword upon his thigh and go back and forth from gate to gate in the camp and kill every man his brother and every man his friend and every man his neighbor. So the sons of Levi did as Moses instructed, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. Then Moses said, dedicate yourselves today to the Lord, for every man has been against his son and against his brother, in order that he may bestow a blessing upon you today. So Moses decides to take action, but he's taking action because the people have become out of control. They're untethered. They're lawless. And Aaron had let them get out of control. So there is culpability here that's placed on Aaron. He let this spin out of control. And in so doing, it says, to be a derision among their enemies. And we know from elsewhere that one of the concerns with respect to the people of Israel is that people would see that God brought them out of Egypt, but if, having left Egypt, they become a lawless people, then the question is, what kind of a God is this that led them out of Egypt? That they should be, of all people, they should be lawful. They should be under control. So Moses says, whoever is on Yahweh's side, step over here. People have to make the choice. People have to decide, are they on Yahweh's side or are they not? Those that are on Yahweh's side, the ones who come over with Moses, for the most part, are the members of the tribe of Levi. It's the Levites who come to his side. Remember, Moses is a Levite, Aaron is a Levite, and it's the Levites then that come over and join him. And Moses says to them, strap a sword on and go through the camp and kill those. You need to kill people, even if it is your brother or your friend or your neighbor. If they are guilty, they need to be killed. Now, there were a lot of people in the camp. There are 3,000 that are killed. I assume that what's happening is that the ringleaders, the ones who were avidly behind the creation of this golden calf, are the ones that are being killed. If you'll recall, Moses took the calf, burned the wooden portion of it, pulverized what's left, and made the people drink that mixed with water. And I pointed out last week that that's similar to the test that's supposed to be used with respect to a woman who is accused of adultery, and it's not clear whether she has committed adultery or not. I don't know how that test for adultery works. And I don't know how this could have worked, but it is possible that there would have been some indication after having drank this concoction that there would have been a similar kind of response to it as with the test for adultery. And if that's the case, then there may have been a way to determine then who were the ringleaders from that test. But even if that's not the case, presumably these Levites who are going through the camp with their swords are picking out those who were particularly culpable, because only 3,000 are put to death. But among those people, there would have been those who were relatives or friends or neighbors of the Levites that are going through the camp and killing them. Then Moses says, dedicate yourself today to the Lord, for every man has been against his son and against his brother, in order that he may bestow a blessing upon you today. This blessing came at a high cost. That is, they had to be willing to do what God had said, even at the expense of killing friends and neighbors and relatives. Casuto says, precisely because you evinced by your action that your zeal for the Lord's honor superseded your natural human affection for your kith and kin. And Moberly says, the primary significance of the story is to show that death is the penalty for unfaithfulness to Yahweh and the covenant, whereas blessing is the reward for faithfulness. Whenever I see a passage like this in the Old Testament, I do find it troubling because it is very troubling to our modern sensibilities that God would have a group of people, the Levites, go through the camp and kill others with the sword because they have sinned. I think we all sense that that's troublesome. There are a couple of things that are helpful to keep in mind in this kind of situation. One is, they were carrying out a judgment from God. God could have killed those 3,000 people by another means. A disease. The ground swallowing them up. Fire coming down from heaven. I mean, there are a number of ways that God has carried out judgments in the Old Testament, and he could have used one of those in this case as well. But in this case, for whatever reasons, God chose to use human beings as his form of judgment, but they are carrying out the judgment of God. The other thing that I think is helpful to keep in mind is that this was exceptional. This was not standard practice. This was a particular period of time in history that God was doing a certain kind of thing with his people and wanted to make clear that the choice that's before them is a difficult choice. It means even having to choose between God, loyalty to God, and loyalty to one's friendships, human friendships, etc. And this is the way that God chose to work this out. Just as a digression, my suspicion is that in our lifetime, there will be people that will start raising the issue of holy war in Israel and saying that, and comparing that with jihad in the Muslim world and saying, it's the same thing. And I think, as a result, I think Jews are going to have to make a defense for the Old Testament, for the presence of the holy war scenarios within the Old Testament. And I think one of the things that's going to have to be made clear is that in the Old Testament, these kinds of things are indeed exceptional. That there were certain things that God wanted to accomplish at certain times and use that kind of vehicle. But it is not something that is intended for us to conduct on an ongoing basis. And I think that is a significant difference between the Old Testament, holy war, and Islamic jihad. So, 3,000 people were killed at that time as a result of what they had done while Moses was up on the mountain. The last section of this chapter. And it came about on the next day that Moses said to the people, "You yourselves have committed a great sin, and now I am going up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Alas, this people has committed a great sin, and they have made a god of gold for themselves. But now, if thou wilt, forgive their sin, and if not, please blot me out from thy book which thou hast written." And the Lord said to Moses, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book. But go now, lead the people where I told you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I punish, I will punish them for their sin." Then the Lord smote the people because of what they did with the calf which Aaron had made. This is the second time, then, that Moses has appealed to God on behalf of the people since the incident of the calf. The first time was when he was still on the mountain, and he begged God, "Don't destroy them." And God relented. God decided not to destroy them. He's going to go one more time in the next chapter, and we'll talk about that when we get there. Moses is going back the second time, and he'll go back again the third time, because apparently, from Moses' perspective, there hasn't been a complete reconciliation. There won't be a complete reconciliation until Israel, the people of Israel, have been restored to the status that they had before they had made the golden calf. That they're on the same terms with God that they were before the golden calf. And that has not yet been achieved, and he recognizes that that has not yet been achieved. So he goes to God, trying to get atonement for the people. And once again, as I pointed out last time that he talked to God about this, he makes no defense for the people. He doesn't say they aren't all that bad, or what they did wasn't horrible, they've only done it one time. There's nothing like that. None of his appeal is based on any merits with respect to the people. It is all an appeal to God and his sensibilities. In this case, he asks, but now, if thou wilt forgive their sin, and if not, please blot me out from thy book which thou hast written. So the question is, what is that book? Sarna says that in the opinion of the rabbis, there were three books that are referred to as God's books. Let me read this paragraph about this. He says, this request seems to reflect a well-rooted and widespread Near Eastern popular belief in the existence of heavenly books. The Hebrew Bible differentiates three types. There is the Book of Life, mentioned in Psalm 69:28, in which God is thought to inscribe the names of all the living. This notion undoubtedly drew its inspiration from the civil census lists that were kept by municipal or state authorities. Then there is the Book of Divine Decrees, in which the destinies of men and women and of peoples are recorded. Lastly, there is the Book of Remembrance in Malachi 3:16, in which the deeds of human beings, both good and evil, are written up. This last must have its origin in ancient court procedure. It is hard to decide whether or not the notion of heavenly books was taken literally in ancient Israel. Maimonides unambiguously emphasizes the figurative, non-literal nature of the biblical phraseology. In the present instance, Moses' request is framed in the figurative language of the Book of Life, so that he is really asking to die if Israel is not forgiven. So Moses has decided his appeal to God is going to include a statement that if God decides that these people need to be eliminated, wiped out, then he wants to be wiped out as well. He wants to have his name removed from the Book of Life. As I was reading this, I was thinking, is this manipulation on Moses' part? Should we see this as being manipulative? And I think that it really depends on the attitude of Moses. Is Moses using this in order to get the result that he wants? Or is Moses just so identifying with the people that he wants to share their same fate, whatever that is? And I'm inclined to think that it's the latter, that it's not manipulative. In making this appeal, I thought about this for quite some time, and I think that he's actually making a very powerful argument. Moses is so completely identifying with his people at this point that it is fitting that he suffers the same fate as the others. He's one of them. He should suffer the same fate that they did. Even though he was not a participant in the sin for which they would be destroyed. But we know from the Old Testament narrative earlier in Genesis that God won't destroy the truly righteous with the wicked. That at Sodom and Gomorrah, Abraham negotiated with God and made the appeal, you wouldn't kill them all if it would mean also wiping out 10 righteous. And you know the negotiations that took place there. And I think what we are to understand from that narrative is that no righteous were destroyed. Lot was saved. So Moses is so identifying with his people, he's saying, we deserve the same fate. And if God will not destroy the righteous, then he won't destroy the people of Israel, because Moses is guiltless in this respect. God responds to this, and his response is difficult to interpret. There are two ways to understand this, though. There are at least two ways to understand this response. The first is God is simply restating his position. I'm gonna punish the wicked. Step aside. I'm gonna punish the wicked. He says, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book. But go now, lead the people where I told you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. So it's possible the way he's saying is, I haven't changed my mind. I'm gonna kill the wicked. I'm gonna just punish the wicked. But go your way. I will send an angel in front of you. The other possibility is that God is giving in somewhat to the appeal of Moses and saying, "Don't worry. I will only punish the wicked. Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book." So it's just the wicked who will be punished. And then he says that he'll send his angel to lead them. Moberly says, however one interprets the precise emphasis of verse 33, the point at issue seems to be that Israel is to have some future, yet is subject to God's disfavor. So there will be some punishment, but Israel still has a future. In this response from God, there's still a tension that can be felt, especially when he says, my angel shall go before you. We'll see that that's a big deal. What God is saying is, I'll lead you, but I'm going to lead you via my representative, an angel. And we'll see later on, there's a big distinction between having God send an angel to lead the people and God being there himself with them and leading the people. And it's the latter that Moses wants to have happen. So the issue has not been resolved. There's still tension between God and the people of Israel, and Moses is going to work to try to resolve that, as we'll see in the next chapter. But it's this tension that I've mentioned before that we're seeing pop up here again. How can a holy and righteous God draw close to a sinful and rebellious people? How can that happen? It's just a disaster waiting to happen. Niehaus says with respect to this is the Old Testament dilemma. God wants to reveal himself to humanity, and humanity needs to have a revelation of God. God's presence is our life, as the Aaronic blessing well shows. But in the Old Testament, that presence must be partly an absence. The self-revelation of God must also be a self-concealment of God. And Sarna says, there was a tragic irony in the episode of the golden calf. The people wanted to provide themselves with a reassuring symbol of God's continued presence in their midst. Yet that very symbol became the instrument of their alienation from God. Although Moses' intercession saves the people from annihilation, Israel has not yet secured full pardon and reconciliation with God. And that won't happen until the next chapter. Okay, so now I want to make a few comments on the whole chapter, both from last week and this week. What was the nature of the wrong that the people of Israel did? In worshiping this golden bull, what was the wrong that they did? I think that there are a few things, there are several things in which they, that indicates the nature of their wrong. The first is, they come to Aaron and they say, make us a bull. Did they say a bull? They specify, they don't think so. Make us a god. Make us an Elohim. So they come to him with a demand rather than a request. It's interesting, they don't come and ask. They don't say, you know, we've got a problem here. What should we do? They don't come for advice. They've already figured out what the solution needs to be. And they come to Aaron with a demand. And as I pointed out last week, the phrasing here indicates that it is a rather hostile interaction that they are having with Aaron, which explains why Aaron was cowed. So at the least, they were guilty of insubordination. But secondly, it seems, and I think that this chapter is written in such a way that it steers us towards the understanding that what the people want is an idol. It makes sense, having been raised in Egypt, where they all worshipped idols. That's the culture in which they grew up. What is the solution to the problem that they are in? And the problem that they are in is they're out in the desert. They have no help. They need help desperately. In fact, they need divine help in order for them to survive. So what do? You make an idol. That's what their cultural upbringing would have said to do. They're willing to have this idol represent the God that brought them out of Egypt. Sure, this Yahweh would be fine with us. But we just need him in a form that's comfortable for us. So they are going to think about that God, whatever God that is, if it's Yahweh, fine, if it's some other God, great. But they're going to think about that God in pagan terms. A God that is manipulable, that's approachable, that's responsive, and that's available. That's what they want. Aaron, in listening to their response, listening to their demand, I think he's trying to put it in the, trying to reframe it, put a spin on it that makes it acceptable. And so it's Aaron then that says, we'll make a bull. Instead of any other figure, it's going to be a bull. I think that Aaron is trying to avoid making an idol, something that's clearly an idol, because that would be in direct violation of the commandments that God had given. But a bull in the ancient world was thought to be a place for God to stand. And this was an especially common notion in Egypt, and the bull was used for this purpose in other times. Sarna says, the calf made by Aaron was not at all intended to represent the deity, but was to function as the pedestal of the invisible God of Israel. Here again, we can adduce any number of examples from the art of the ancient Near East, wherein gods stand upon animals, mostly bulls and lions. The pedestal elevated the god above the human level, and the particular animal might be suggestive of the god's attributes. Aaron's calf would then be one more example of this practice, in which case Aaron would have followed accepted artistic convention, except that since the God of Israel may not be represented in material form, his presence on the calf would be left to human imagination. This brings us back once again to the tabernacle parallel, to the function of the cherubim, as we have explained it. The calf serves the same purpose as they do. The cherubim, as you recall, essentially hold up the throne of God. They represent the throne of God where he sits. So, seen from this perspective then, the bull was essentially just an invitation for the God, whatever God, to come down and be present in their midst. Just a little digression that I find interesting. Umberto Casuto says that this perspective appears to have been resurrected at a later time in the history of Israel. When the northern kingdom separated from the southern kingdom, the northern kingdom began to worship God, Yahweh, in a different location because they didn't want all of their people going to Jerusalem to worship, to celebrate the festivals. So in two calf statues were made. And Casuto speculates that they may have revived a kind of Aaronic theology, that is, the theology of Aaron, who made this calf at Mount Sinai, and that they were therefore reverting back to the roots of Israel's religion, true religion, before it went astray. And that those calves then were symbols of the place where Yahweh would come and stand in their midst. And he points out that even the names of the priests that were set up at that time under Jeroboam are reflective of the names of the errant sons of Aaron, errant, that is, the ones that went astray, sons of Aaron. Remember, two of his sons were killed for burning strange fire in the tabernacle. Okay, that's a digression. So what would be wrong about this, making this golden calf? If they aren't worshiping the golden calf, they're worshiping Yahweh who comes and stands on that calf. Sarna says it was wrong because it still, quote, put God back into nature. And Casuto takes the same perspective. Let me read more fully what Sarna says. In the popular mind, the image pedestal could not but be endowed with divinity. God was put back into nature. The fundamental distinctive idea of the religion of Israel was thereby violated and nullified. Instead of the unique, revolutionary idea of the divine word enshrined in the Holy of Holies as the token of the immediacy of the divine presence, there was a profane, plastic image which could easily be recognized as falling within the orbit of paganism. The situation in the wilderness thus produced two different contradictory and mutually exclusive responses. The one illegitimate and distortive, the golden calf. The other legitimate and corrective, the tabernacle. I would love to sit down and explore Sarna's perspective here. I'm not sure whether I would agree with it or disagree with it. The dominant view from Sarna, Kasuro, and some other commentators is that what they did wrong was to create an idol or an image. But as I've thought about it, I think that it's a little more subtle, a little more slippery than that. Do a thought experiment. What if the people of Israel had come to Aaron and they had said, make for us a tabernacle and make for us in that tabernacle some furniture. And one of the things, pieces of furniture in that tabernacle will be the Ark of the Covenant. And it'll be 2 cubits by 1.5 cubits and 2 cherubim on it. Would that have been wrong? Would the people of Israel have been wrong in doing that? That's exactly what God is going to command them to do. That's what he's told Moses to do on the mountain. So if they had come to Aaron now and said, while Moses was still up on the mountain, and they give him the blueprint that God is giving to Moses on the mountain, they said, make this for us. Would that have been wrong? And I think the answer is yes, it would have been wrong. There are several aspects to what they're doing that I think is wrong. The first is impatience. They just freaked out. Instead of trusting God to take care of them, they're trying to solve this problem, and God is solving this already. He's taking care of exactly this problem. The second is they come up with their own solution rather than caring how God would want them to solve this problem. Third is they are wanting to conceive of Yahweh as a pagan god. They would rather have Yahweh a pagan god than Yahweh be Yahweh. That's what they're used to, and a pagan god is more approachable, more responsive. It's a god that's easier to relate to. Furthermore, there's the safety of the conventional. Human beings are more sheep-like than we would like to admit. We like being in the herd. We like doing what the others are doing. There's safety in it. There's comfort there. To do something that's unconventional, that's different, seems it's difficult. It fights against the grain. I mean, at Gutenberg, the question frequently would come up, yeah, but is this a real college education? How can it be? It doesn't have a football team. And those kinds of things. And so the unconventional is difficult. We don't like it. We're very sheep-like. And pagan gods seem to work fine for most people. Why can't we have a pagan god? But to worship the pagan version of Yahweh is to worship a different god. And that's the sense in which what they were doing was adulterous. They can still call him Yahweh. They can say that Yahweh's coming down on this calf. But they're really thinking of him in different terms. They've turned him into a different god in their minds that they're worshiping. And that is adulterous-like. It was a breach of the trust of their marriage-like relationship. I was trying to think how to describe what it is that God wants of us, and what is it that the Ten Commandments are getting at? What are they requiring of us? What do they want of us? And the best I can do is what God wants of us is that we relate to him as the righteous, transcendent creator God that he is. And if you think about that he's righteous, transcendent, and our creator, it has to be humbling. And if we don't approach him and think in those terms that recognize the humility that we need to have in coming before him, then we have turned him into a pagan god. We are not worshiping Yahweh of the Bible. I find that sobering. And that's what, as I was thinking about this while I was studying it, that really struck me. I think the nature of Aaron's sin is a little different. I don't think he was worshiping another god, but he lacked courage. He caved into the mob. They intimidated him, and he ended up making some choices. That is, he goes ahead and makes the calf rather than confronting them. And I think he ended up compromising his values as a result of it. And things spun out of control. And all of this was so silly, if you look at it in the context of Exodus, it was so silly because God was already addressing the very problem that they're so concerned with. The whole account of 32:1-6 can be seen as heavily ironic. These are the words of Moberly. This is clearest in the juxtaposition of 32:1-6 with 25:1-9. Not only is there irony here, but also theological reflection on the nature of sin. The people want a symbol of Yahweh's presence. In their impatience, they demand and make for themselves what Yahweh has already made provision for and is about to give them. What Aaron and the people do is in many ways similar to what Yahweh has specified. Yet because they push ahead without waiting for Yahweh's directions through Moses, their work is but a parody, which far from assuring Yahweh's presence and accompaniment, simply forfeits it. Likewise, the people's attempt to affirm the identity of the calf with Yahweh by echoing Exodus 20, verse 2, is to be seen as a parody of the true nature and purposes of Yahweh. So you can tell from the context in Exodus that it only appeared to them that God was not attentive to their needs and concerns. In fact, he was attentive, and he was taking care of them. They just couldn't see his attention. The other thing that struck me in this section was the character of Moses. I had undervalued the significance of Moses in the Exodus narrative before this time through it. He is playing a huge role, and he's doing some really amazing things. And we have seen Moses change over time, and we see another big change in this passage. If you will recall, the way that I'm understanding the earlier passage, when Moses has been told by God to go back to Egypt and lead the people out, that there is this incident where Moses almost dies of some kind of disease or something. And it's a weird passage, but I think what we are supposed to see in that passage is that the thing that saved him was the circumcision of his son. His son had not been circumcised. And I think that we are to understand from that Moses had ceased to identify with his people. When Moses had been in Egypt, was raised as a son of Pharaoh, got to be an adult, he wanted to do things to free his people from the slavery and the oppression that they were under. And he took actions to do that. But in so doing, the people of Israel rejected him, rejected his authority, didn't want his help, and were willing to turn him into rat on him and get him into trouble. So he fled. And for 40 years, he was a shepherd out in the wilderness. And I think that during that 40-year period of time, he had decided, I'm done with the Israelites. That psychologically he had divorced himself from his people. But at that point in time when God calls him back and he's about to die, but he circumcises, I think it's his wife, circumcises his son, and and his health is restored, I think that we are to understand that he is reconnecting with his people psychologically. But now, after the experiences in the wilderness, in which the people have not exactly fully embraced Moses, they haven't fully granted him the authority that they should have granted to him. Despite that, Moses has grown to fully identify with his people more than he ever has before. The people haven't changed. They aren't better people. But Moses has come to, I guess, appreciate them and see in them what God had seen in them. And he's logged a lot of miles with them. So whatever it is, he is now fully identifying with them, such that when there's the possibility that God will wipe them out, Moses says, I'm one of them. If you're going to wipe them out, I go too. I find that truly amazing and incredible, the incredible humility that he is exhibiting there. God gave him the opportunity to be the founder of a new nation. God was going to wipe out all the rest of them and made essentially the same promise to him that he made to Abraham, out of you I will make a nation for me. And Moses said, no, that would not be good. This is my people. I identify with them. We are one. If they go, I go. I find that he's an amazing, amazing character. The last thing I want to talk about is the Jewish feasts. I've mentioned this before. This is a very minority view held by two people, as far as I know. But I'm just going to briefly lay it out for you, and you can decide for yourselves whether I'm right or crazy. As you know, there are seven feasts that God commanded the Israelites to celebrate. One of the things that is surprising to me and striking to me is there are so few details about what these feasts are all about, what they mean and how they're to be celebrated. The Bible just doesn't contain those details. The one notable exception is the Passover, and I'll come back to that. But other than the Passover, there's virtually nothing about how they are to be celebrated and what they're for. But my assumption is that these feasts have some kind of significance, that they were meaningful to the people of Israel, and they should continue to be meaningful to us if they have meaning. I think that the having the Israelites celebrate the feasts marks key events in the history of the nation's flight from Egypt, and that this is a really good purpose that they're serving, because that first year in Israel's history, the year of the Exodus, is, I think, the most important year in the history of Israel until you get to the time of Jesus. It says a huge amount about who Yahweh is, about what kind of people the Israelites are, and how those two interact. So, here's my perspective. It seems to me that the seven feasts are designed to be an annual review of the key events of the Exodus. That they are tied to the Exodus. The Exodus provides us the historical background for those feasts and is then an annual reminder of that first year. If that's true, then each feast commemorates a distinct event in Exodus, It would make sense that they would be in the same order as those events in Exodus. And it's possible that they would actually be celebrated on the day that corresponds to that event in the book of Exodus. Now, what makes me think that this might be the case? Well, I take Passover to be paradynamic. It is said in Leviticus 23 that Passover is the beginning of the year, just before Passover, 2 weeks before Passover is the beginning of the year. Well, that's the beginning of the religious year. For other purposes, there are other beginnings of the year. We have different beginnings of the year as well. But for the beginning of the religious year, that Passover is at the beginning, the first month. And we know that Passover is specifically said to be in commemoration of the Passover event in Exodus. So it was historically at the beginning of the Exodus period. How this feast was to be celebrated is then described in great detail. And we get it in Exodus. We also get that in Leviticus and in Deuteronomy. And the celebration of that feast, the Passover, is designed to be a reliving, in a sense, of that event. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, we don't have much detail about how it is to be celebrated or what it's for, as with the others. We don't have much explanation, unlike Passover. But the Feast of Unleavened Bread, we are told that the people are to eat unleavened bread for a week, the Israelites, in remembrance of having to leave Egypt in a hurry. So once again, it is in some way tied to the narrative in Exodus. The Feast of First Fruits, very little is told about how that's to be celebrated and what it's for. But the first grain harvest is to be given to God, the first grain harvested. And chronologically, the Feast of First Fruits appears to correspond with the crossing of the Red Sea. Pentecost, or Shavuot, that's the offering to God of the first of the second harvest. But if you work out the chronology in Exodus, Shavuot corresponds to the time when God gave the Ten Commandments to the people of Israel. As a result, in Jewish culture, Pentecost has become a celebration of receiving the law from God. The next one is the Feast of Trumpets, which is the most obscure of all the holidays. It's to be celebrated by and the word can mean either a blowing of trumpets or it can mean a shouting. And all it says is as a memorial, but it doesn't say a memorial of what? Isn't that great? But how is it celebrated? It is celebrated as a day of mourning and repentance that begins on the Feast of Trumpets and continues through Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. So for 10 days, I think it is. This is something I got from the internet. I think this was from the Jews for Jesus site. It says, the Feast of Trumpets heralded the arrival of that seventh month. It also began what is known as the 10 days of awe between the Feast of Trumpets and the Day of Atonement, wherein the penitent humble themselves in preparation for the great Day of Atonement. What did trumpets signify in the Old Testament? I think trumpets signify more than one thing in the Old Testament, but one strong correlation is the trumpet is blown when the holy meets the profane. That in instances where the holy intersects with the profane, there are trumpets blowing is common. I'll just point out, Sabbath begins with the blowing of a trumpet. Oftentimes, there is judgment connected with that. So the trumpet has strong association with the righteous coming in judgment. So what event in Exodus would this map onto, the Feast of Trumpets? I think it's when Moses and Joshua were coming down the hill and they heard a shouting. They heard the very sound that feast is talking about. The chronological information in Exodus is too incomplete to be able to say that the day on which Joshua and Moses came down from the mountain corresponds with the day when they were supposed to celebrate the Feast of Trumpets. So I can't say that those correspond, but given the data that is there, it's possible that those dates would correspond. Then the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, that's a day of fasting and repentance. Jews are supposed to fast for 24 hours, eat nothing, and drink nothing. And my son-in-law, we were talking to my daughter this morning, and my son-in-law fasted for Yom Kippur, and he said, it really makes you feel mortal, which is interesting. Once again, the chronological information isn't adequate to pinpoint whether there's an event in Exodus that corresponds to this. But my guess is that it corresponds to Moses asking God for atonement for the people of Israel. Then the seventh feast is the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot, and that is the most celebratory of the feasts. The seventh is the most celebratory, and I'll talk more about that when I get to it as I proceed through Exodus. But that's my working hypothesis, is that the seven feasts that the Israelites were supposed to celebrate, that those map on to these particular events in Egypt and therefore constitute an annual review of what happened when God led the people of Israel out of Egypt. So that's something that you can ponder over. Questions or comments?
Thanks, David. Mm-hmm. So if I understand you right, should our attention be less upon the calf as the grievous thing and more upon what they did with the calf, the sacrificing and the dancing and the partying as really the issue, that it was their desire to engage in these known practices that they believed they could use to affect a certain outcome with God, that was really the issue?
Yes. That, and I'm even reluctant to use the word the things that they did or the acts that they did, because it really comes down to their hearts. That what they were, I think what we are encouraged to understand by the use of vocabulary that has strong associations with idolatry and paganism, that what they had done is they had decided that they wanted to worship a familiar god, a pagan-like god. And they could slap the name of Yahweh on that god. That was fine with them. But what was important, what was really significant, is they wanted to worship a pagan god. And that's what they were doing. And that's what God is responding to. I'm not that kind of God. You aren't worshiping me, you're worshiping something else.
Thank you, David. I wonder if another problem with the situation is that back in chapter 24, one of the last things that people were commanded to do is they could not approach God, and that may not have been one of the Ten Commandments, but that was certainly something God commanded them not to do, and that would inherently be broken in this situation.
Yeah, there were the commandments with respect to the mountain then, and then there are the instructions with respect to the tabernacle, all of which are designed to instill in people an understanding that God is so holy that I don't know exactly how to phrase it, but he needs to be recognized as a righteous, transcendent, holy God. And we don't just walk up to him and like one of our friends. He's a different kind of thing. And they lost sight of that.
Thanks, David. It seems to me like what you're describing them as doing, that would be appropriate to sum it up as idolatry, because it seems that what idolatry is itself is a more subtle thing than just making kind of the cartoon version of, I made this statue, I bow down and think it's bringing me good things and feed it. Like, the whole point behind it is subverting God's order, the way that God, the way he's made the world and what we are supposed to be as part of that.
Right.
It's trying to subvert that and say, you're too weird. You know, God, you're too weird. I don't like the way you're doing things. So I'm going to do it in this way that makes sense to me.
Right.
And it seems like that's what you're saying, is their sin, that Aaron tries to put that in a better light, but he fails at that because you can't put that in a better light. But that there's still, maybe it wasn't on his initiative to do that.
Right.
It
is idolatry. Mm-hmm. But in the past, to see it as idolatry certainly gets me off the hook, because I have never been tempted to bow down before a calf. So it's helpful for me to recognize what's at the heart of this is not recognizing who God really is and responding and relating to him for who he really is rather than some caricatured version of who he is.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I had one thought about the punishment that Moses kind of puts on the people of killing them.
Mm-hmm.
The language here sounds to me like it's kind of an indiscriminate, you know, go out and kill. And that the reason that it's only 3,000 that die is because they just do it for a day. So that's all the people they were able to kill in a day. But that it really was like all of the people have done this, so go and start wreaking this judgment on the people, and they stop after a day. What do you think about that?
It's possible, because it is not clear that it is discriminate. But I think that the wording could be there to emphasize the fact that they are going to have to take the lives of people that they have relationships with. So you have to go through the camp, and you're going to have to kill people that you have relationships with. We aren't told on what basis they decide who to kill and who not to kill. I don't know how long it takes to kill 3,000 people, but my suspicion is if you have a number of Levites there that are doing it, that they could kill more than 3,000 in a day. But I don't know.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if you could talk about the difference between jihad and the holy war. And if I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit, looks like David goes out and wars against his enemies every summer. Wouldn't he see that in the same sort of light?
No, I wouldn't see that in the same light. That was not holy war. The holy war was and the rules given for holy war were only applicable when they were first coming into the promised land and when they were fighting against the Canaanites. And in there, it was specifically judgment with respect to the Canaanites.
It seems like in Psalms, David is always talking about, hey, my enemies surround me. The enemies of God surround me.
Right, right.
You still don't think that?
No, because it's not, that is not holy war. Holy war is a technical term. It doesn't just mean warfare against God's enemies. It was warfare that God wanted to be conducted against a specific people at a specific time for a specific reason, and it was judgment.
So like there's a special Hebrew word for that?
Well, yeah, that they were placed under the ban. Mm-hmm. So there's a term that's used for that.
You asked the question, how can a holy God draw near to a sinful people or draw near a sinful people? What other kind of people are there?
Right. That's the problem.
And the other thing is, what's it going to cost him?
What's it going to cost them?
Him.
What's it going to cost God? Well, that's the dilemma here. And I think that's the dilemma that we're seeing in Exodus, and we'll see it elsewhere in the Old Testament. God is a holy and a righteous God who wants to have a relationship with sinful, profane human beings. And how can that happen?
How did Jesus do it?
Well, I think that what we have here is an understanding. Moses goes to God and asks for atonement for the people. And I think we have embedded in this story some things that help us to understand what Jesus did.
So I remember hearing the teacher once talking about the only people Jesus hung out with were sinners. And it didn't sully him at all. Touching a sinner didn't make him dirty. Touching an unholy person didn't make him unholy. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, he was morally Teflon'd. Doesn't God have the same ability to intrude into this level of reality, quote unquote, and then go back without being sullied or stained in that? It doesn't, I mean, this is, I've been working through this a lot lately. The only way God can reach out to human beings is to get in the presence, so-called get in the presence of ugly people, sinful, rebellious people. Even if they're not rebelling against him, they're doing horrible things to each other. So they're not really admirable beings. But if he's going to do anything with them, he's sort of like a surgeon going in with no gloves. I got to save their life. But miracle of miracles, he doesn't come out dirty like a surgeon would. So the dilemma doesn't, to me, seem to be how can a God of other, a morally perfect being, have to do with morally imperfect human beings? Because that's the only beings he's got to do with. The question, I think, becomes, given that his moral thermometer is a lot more sensitive than ours, any involvement with human beings carries with it the risk of God being morally offended at all times. So what we're really asking is, where does God get all that patience? Mm-hmm. Where does a forgiveness at that level come from? He's that big. He's that far-sighted. He knows the end game. He knows where he's going with this. And he's willing to put up with it to get there.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot that we talk about in this. This is complicated, and I'm not sure that I've got it all sorted out, but you're right. His patience is phenomenal, but his patience does end.
It's not infinite.
And that's what I mean. His holiness is incompatible with our sinfulness, ultimately.
Ultimately, yeah.
And so the question is, can anything be done about that? And in Exodus, I think what we see is something that can be done about that is that God can be in our midst, but isolated in some way. The tabernacle is God in our midst, in the midst of a sinful people, and yet that is a viable situation for God as a temporary arrangement. And the other is a mediator, that Moses serves as the mediator. Moses is the one that the Israelites wanted to go to God to get the law. And he takes that back to the people. So he becomes the mediator who gives instructions from God to the people. But he also becomes the one who represents the people before God when they have sinned and asks for atonement. So those are the two things that you see in Exodus as, at least in part, solutions to that problem. Okay, I need to let you go. Thanks.